Good morning, everybody. Let's get started with the next presentation. So now we're going to have Julia Fine from UC Santa Barbara presenting on figurative lexicalization and acculturation in Kodiak Aztec.
Hi, thank you for coming so close to the end of the conference. Yeah, so briefly before we get started, I should mention that by acculturation, I don't necessarily mean like one culture just wholesale sort of accommodating to another. I mean that being mediated through various kinds of ideologies, and that's really what this talk is going to be about. So Kodiak Aleutic is an Eskimo Aleut language that I've been working with for the past couple of summers. I got in touch with them through Evan Gardner over there as an intern for Warrior Keys. It's a very closely related language to Yupik. It's sometimes termed Pacific Gulf Yupik, although not by anyone in the actual community. It's severely endangered with under 45 speakers as of an estimate of 2004, so it's probably unfortunately a lot less than that today. But the good news is that there's been a revitalization movement in place from the 90s onwards, and that's taken the form of a master apprentice program, a variety of high school and college classes, as well as community language learning opportunities, many of which are through Warrior Keys, and most recently and very excitingly, an immersion preschool, which I haven't had the chance to do any research on that yet, but I hope to at some point. And for some visual reference, that's what Kodiak Island looks like from the wing of a plane. I was lucky enough to live with a friend whose husband was a pilot this summer. And this is where it is situated geographically. That's Kodiak Island. I specifically work in Kodiak, the city, which is on the sort of northeastern part of the island. There are other villages as well. So to briefly define what I mean by figurative lexicalization, many of you might have heard the generalization that semantic change usually progresses from the concrete to the abstract. So for instance, body parts might come to refer to spatial locations, so like in front of, to the side of, in back of, that kind of thing. But you also see the reverse occurring, not necessarily with grammatical change so much, but just with mappings. So like, even in English, you have things like laptop, where the location, laptop, where the location of the object comes to refer to the object itself, or things like mouse, like if you picture a sort of old-fashioned mouse, it kind of looks like the animal mouse. So this mapping of abstract concepts onto concrete objects can be termed figurative lexicalization, as in Karen Rice's study of Denis Suchine, which is called Our Language is Very Literal, and it is all about
Karen,
that.
It's me.
Oh, sorry about that. Okay, wow. And it's also characteristic of esoteric languages. So, for instance, Kodiak Aleutic is an esoteric language because it's spoken on an island. People mainly interacted with other speakers of Aleutic and not so much with outsiders, as opposed to like a lingua franca. So the research questions that I'm interested in looking at in this presentation are, first, how do figurative or non-figurative lexicalization strategies differ across three time periods in Aleutic history? The first one being pre-contact, in which there was mainly figurative lexicalization. Then the Russian-occupied period, in which mainly there was non-figurative lexicalization or borrowing from Russian. And then the modern period, in which there's a return to figurative lexicalization strategies that very closely parallel the ones used in the pre-contact era. And then finally, I'm going to ask, what can account for these differences? And you can probably already guess that I'm going to talk about different kinds of language ideologies and ideologies towards contact that determined whether figurative lexicalization or borrowing prevailed. To go into a little bit more depth about these eras, the pre-contact era was characterized by an esoteric population, especially during the time when people who spoke Aleutic actually resided on Kodiak Island. You can imagine an island population is going to be fairly self-contained. And in this era, figurative lexicalization abounded. In a couple of moments, I'll show examples of different kinds of semantic domains where figurative lexicalization occurred, and it's basically every domain that I could think of. Yeah, the Russian-occupied period was characterized initially by massacres and forced labor, also by intermarriage and conversion to Russian Orthodoxy. And in fact, many of the elders today still are Russian Orthodox, so that's really still a strong presence on the island. And specifically, this Russian presence was concentrated on the northern part of the island, And you still see more Russian loanwords there and also some Russian discourse markers. So it's like sort of had more of an effect on the northern style. The modern period was initially characterized by boarding schools, English language ones that disrupted intergenerational transmission. You sort of have the familiar story of Aleutic children being punished physically for speaking Aleutic in school, and of course that led to decreased use of Aleutic. But again, there's been a revitalization movement in the past 20-odd years, and that has really reversed a lot of ideologies about Aleutic, and figurative lexicalization is a huge part of that. The data that I'm looking at for this study come from 709 words for concrete objects found in a picture dictionary, which is one of the first pedagogical materials that I was introduced to when I started working with this community, largely because it's just so helpful. This is an example page of that dictionary. It's the numbers page. You can see like there's different numbers of items. This is probably a little too small to read, but the text there is all in Aleutic, so it's nice because there's no translation, and it's organized thematically. So if you want to know about clothes, you go to the clothing page, and you have all of these images laid out. So in this dictionary, there's a mixture of pre-contact words, Russian and English loanwords, and words coined recently by the New Words Council as part of the revitalization movement. And the New Words Council is a body of elders and learners that meets, I think, about monthly to come up with new words for things like technology and material goods. And we'll see some examples of that in a little bit. Also, I was like pretty conservative about terming things figurative lexicalization or not, because there are many cases where it was unclear. So I only said that things were figuratively lexicalized if I could see like a very clear etymology, either from the New Words Council, where it's usually pretty obvious, or from this unpublished dictionary of Kodiak Aleutic, authored by Jeff Lear and other linguists, and that has other dialects in it too. So here are the overall frequency of figurative lexicalization in the sample. You can see that most words were positively identifiable as being derived through figurative lexicalization. Then a substantial chunk were definitely not derived through figurative lexicalization, and another very substantial chunk I just threw up my hands and said I didn't know. This is the rates of figurative lexicalization in non-borrowed words, so that encompasses pre-contact Aleutic as well as modern figurative lexicalization. And that teal part is the words that were derived through figurative lexicalization. It's definitely more than half, almost three quarters. A tiny sliver there is not derived through figurative lexicalization, and then another good chunk is unclear. Then looking specifically at figurative lexicalization in just pre-contact Aleutic, the main difference is that much more of it was unclear to me, maybe because there were processes of figurative lexicalization, but I couldn't really tease the stems apart, or maybe the stems involved weren't documented clearly, so there's just more where I wasn't sure. As some examples of what figurative lexicalization in pre-contact Aleutic looked like, a lot of it was words for tools. So these were often described in terms of what they do, which sort of makes sense for how you would conceptualize a tool. So like minkuduk is a sewing thing or a needle. Ayauk is like a helper or a crutch. Kapsuduk is like a poker or a spear for fishing. Yeah. There's also a lot of non-tool artifacts, largely because this is like my grab bag category for things I was not entirely sure how to categorize, so that includes things like hinahok, which is like a face-like thing or a mask, sungjaodat, which is healing things or medicine, and womkudak, which is a thing for future playing or a toy. There's some nominal tense there. There are a lot of figuratively lexicalized words for animals as well, so like chichanachtulek, the antlered one or the elk, ichaluhok, the moon-like thing or the jellyfish, and the Chilhayuk, the crackling one, or the dragonfly. There's also some for things like locations, and for food and beverages, and for garments. And, kind of most surprisingly to me, there are a lot for body parts too. And I don't know why I was surprised for this, I guess just because body parts seem like such core vocabulary, so you'd think like if figurative lexicalization wasn't going to apply to some semantic domain, it might be that one. But indeed it does, so you get words like anachdakwik, for breathing place or bloho, or that can also mean like the soft spot on a baby's skull. I'm not that familiar with baby anatomy, but I'll take their word for it that that exists. Kumluk is like a scratcher or a thumb. Umwadak is the life-causing thing or the living thing, which means heart. Tunumjuk is like little back. That's the nape of your neck. And most strikingly to me, Pachihuak, the words for nostrils, actually means two gill-like things. Yeah. So I guess also there's like a lot of primacy placed on marine life. In terms, turning now to the loan words, so the words that were not derived through figurative lexicalization, the bulk of them come from Russian, a very small fraction come from English, and an even smaller fraction come from Unangam Tuno. As for why there are so many more Russian loanwords than English ones, one very like kind of prosaic explanation for this is that Russian contact preceded contact with English speakers. So a lot of the technological items introduced overlapped. So like if you already have a word for teapot and that's chainik and it's from Russian, you don't necessarily need to borrow the English word for teapot because it's synonymous with something you already have. But I think there are also ideological reasons not to borrow English words. And there are English words that could have been borrowed but weren't. So because there was prior assimilation to Russian culture, the imposition of these new American words infringed not only on Aleutic identity, but also on Russian Aleutic identity. And I think also like this kind of cultural contact doesn't ever happen the same way twice. So the Aleutic people after Russian contact were not viewing contact with English speakers the same way as they had viewed Aleutic Russian contact when that occurred. They sort of like had seen it before. And I think that's part of why there's this conscious decision to coin figurative Aleutic words in settings like the New Words Council rather than just adopting English loan words. I should also mention that English words do get used sometimes in code switching, but they're not really incorporated into curriculum materials that are being used in the immersion school, the high school, the college, etc. And they're also not fully prosodically or phonologically adopted into Aleutic. So you might especially hear elders saying things like, Hui nahioka chistun drive. And there's like a little break there. Drive is an English word, technology related, totally not affected by Aleutic phonology. And that's very different than the English loanwords in the sample, which are Aleuticized. So that includes like, I'll go over this pretty quickly because I'm running out of time, but like foods and beverage words like chizak for cheese, you can see that's the absolutive suffix, that Q on the end there. So they get Aleutic morphology on them. Clothing items, vehicles, my non-tool artifact category cropping up yet again with kaitak for kite and hojak for hose. And also one place name. The Russian loanwords are kind of too numerous to list in full detail, but most of them were non-tool artifacts, my grab bag category, then foods and beverages, then tools, then clothing items, and yeah, that's like the most common categories for that. Also interesting is that once Aleutic borrows a word, that's not like game over for figurative lexicalization. That borrowed stem is still eligible to be used in creating new words from that. So for instance, alatihuak in the northern style or alachihuak in the southern style is the word for donut. And that comes from the stem alatik or alachak, meaning fry bread, plus this postface huak, which means like false noun or fake noun or something that kind of resembles something else but is not the same thing. And that means donut. So you can kind of see some visual similarities there. Also, mind-blowing side note, this word alajik or alajik comes from a Russian word that is the ancestor of the word lutka. Wild. Okay. In terms of semantic types of figurative lexicalization with borrowed roots, a lot of it is possession, so like nyukhnechat bukichet, the word's buttons is keyboard. Chlebam luchtsiti, bread charring thing or bread roasting thing, is a toaster. Mashlaudok, butter thing, butter dish. Supahwek, soup place, bowl. Slabaha, cat-like thing, mushroom. You can see there's like all kinds of different types of figurative lexicalization in play here. And you get augmentative and diminutive things as well as like diminutive slash resemblance. There's like mwak suffix that means like a little N like N. Yeah. All right. Moving quickly through this. So figurative lexicalization in the New Words Council, as you can imagine, was spurred on by a need for new words, especially for technology, so things like electrical socket, computer, etc. It's a gathering of elders and learners who collaboratively coin these new words, and they use the same figurative lexicalization post bases that were in use in the pre-contact era. So this interesting continuity of Aleutic epistemology, even as they coin words for these very new and foreign kinds of technology. And April Counselor actually wrote a lot about this, and she notes the social benefits for the participating elders who feel a sense of connection to the younger generation that will be learning the language, as well as for the learners who attend the meeting because they are able to see the elders interacting in this kind of cool collaborative way. And some participant quotes here. One elder says, "We used to talk Aleutic and just have to go back to English, but now we have our own words." So that kind of hints that using English might induce some kind of like triggering phenomena where they fully switch into English after using an English word. Another elder says, "To be working on the language for our future is very exciting." And another elder, sort of echoing that, says, "For me, it's fun to just create new words with the stem of whatever the thing does. I really enjoy that and having all the input from everybody." So there's like this emphasis on how fun it is, how enjoyable, and that's not to be underestimated in a revitalization setting, how important that kind of thing can be. Just to showcase a little bit of the humor and inventiveness in figurative lexicalization, here are some highlights. So one fun calc is uchanahuak, kind of like a mouse, and that means computer mouse. There's like a lot of creative and informative descriptions. So like umdu seikalak is a loud cycle or a motorcycle. Kind of interesting portmanteau there. Umiachtushkak is the thinker or the computer. Kwingchahaitskak is like a thing that you don't have to walk on or a moving walkway. And Nashlech Yahoskak Karag, probably many of us will take them in the near future, is a car you have to pay for or a taxi. Yeah, there's also some onomatopoeia, so like choo-choo-hawk or choo-choo-wop is like a choo-choo thing or a train. So this is all fun and nice, but there's also kind of a sobering side to this, which is, so the word suhpyok in the Aleutic language is a name for Aleutic people, and it means real person. And this distinction between hwak and pyok, as Alicia Drabeck notes in her dissertation, is really important to Aleutic culture. So how are you supposed to be suhpyok, a real person, when you're living in this world of fake or not real things? And there are a lot of them. I won't go through this list, but it just illustrates how many hwaks there are being used in the language. This is just like a small subset of them. So you kind of have the Aleutic, modern Aleutic speaker represented here by this petroglyph, surrounded by all of these fake, weird things, which just seems kind of like a collection of random objects here. But the way that they resolve this conflict is by conceptualizing them in terms of more primary or real things. So like a flashlight is a nanihuak, a stone lamp-like thing. A rocking horse is a kunihuak, a horse-like thing. Ketchup, you can probably guess, tumatushahuak, tomato-like thing. Milkshake, murukuhuak, milk-like thing. Strawberry, alahanahuak, salmonberry-like thing. This makes sense if you've seen salmonberries growing wild in that region. Coca-Cola is tangahuak, a water-like thing that can also refer to liquor. And then this rubber duck is sakolahuak, a duck-like thing. Fairly self-evident why. And not all of these things on the inner circle here actually are indigenous items. So like horses are not native to the island at all. Neither is milk, but you will note that they're like much less processed. And the things in the outer periphery tend to be branded. So you have things like McDonald's, you have Heinz, you have Coca-Cola. So an interesting part of this kind of figurative lexicalization is that it's kind of anti-consumerist, because Coca-Cola, McDonald's, etc., are trying to position themselves as really intrinsic to your identity, to your Americanness, to your whole way of life. And the Aleutic is kind of saying, no, no, we are based on real things, and you are just completely parenthetical to our sense of self. So also, I think maybe in terms of health and wellness, if you're thinking of what you're going to eat, you might prefer to not like eat some fake tomatoes along with your fake milk and your fake water, you might just have like some real food instead. Yeah.
Anything to add about how you think the experience of Russian acculturation affected the approach to American acculturation?
Yeah, so that's like a really complicated issue, and I think it varies very much from person to person. Because, so like, not all of the people who I've been working with today are that into the Russian aspects of culture. It really depends on people's particular family trees and experiences. But for some people, like, Russian culture is really synonymous with Aleutic culture. It's like, our parents were Russian Orthodox, they were devout, we are devout, we are devout people. So it's like, it's very fused. And then to have yet another wave of cultural contact is like, come on, no. Like, we have already, like, made space in our way of being to include Russian norms. We are not about to do that again for yet more outsiders type of a thing, I think.
Is that do you find that explicitly articulated anywhere, or is it sort of just inferred?
It's something I've kind of pieced together from talking to particularly one of the elders who is like very devout Russian Orthodox, and like her dad was a reader in church, and she's always saying like these white people came, and now like she talks a lot about how church traditions have changed and how like she doesn't like it that all the services are in English now instead of Russian. And she constantly draws these links between being a Aleutic and like singing in Russian, which is really interesting. Yeah. I may be overgeneralizing a little bit because I've heard her talk about this so much. And it's definitely not true for all of the elders. Many of them are also like somewhat opposed to Russian Orthodoxy.
So are there any speakers of Russian?
I don't think so. Not in the people that I'm working with specifically. A lot of the elders will code switch into Russian as well sometimes, and they are definitely aware of like which words are Russian and which are not. Like they'll say, oh yeah, that's a Russian one. Yeah, but I don't think anyone is fluent in Russian really. Definitely their parents were though.
Are there any Russian people speaking English?
On the island?
Yeah.
Yes, there are. There's like a coffee shop that is exclusively run by like Russian Orthodox people who are also English speakers. There are a lot of Russian priests. There's even like, I don't know too much about this, but I know that there's kind of like a very old-fashioned group of Russian people. I don't totally know what their deal is, but they like...
Old believers.
Yes. Thank you. I couldn't think of the word for them. Yes, there's old believers near Kodiak too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was just going to ask if you saw this being used in schools, and how were they integrated, and did they also instruct like a deeper meaning, a metaphor or figurative use?
Yeah, so I guess like a lot of the work of the New Words Council arises from this very practical need for like, how do we say pencil holder because we don't want to switch into English? So I don't think students were explicitly instructed in like the deeper meaning of figurative lexicalization for that kind of classroom word, but I know that those words are used in the classroom. I think, however, that they might be explicitly taught about plok and pyok, like real versus fake. Yeah, I know that students have kind of started using plok as like index of being an Aleutic learner. Like, there's this phrase, like, just hawk it out. Yeah, because people recognize that hawk is really prevalent and really useful. Yeah. Yep.
I was just curious about the, I guess, the chronological, like, you have a couple of examples, so we catch up, and then you were talking about the word for bowl,
mm-hmm.
that have incorporated into them the borrowings.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's just interesting to me that the new council is just trying to kind of stay clear of the borrowings, but then the words are based on borrowings? Like how that happened on a lot of
Right, yeah. That's interesting, because you would think that if there's this primacy being placed on using only elutic words, then like figurative lexicalization from borrowing shouldn't count, right? Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm just curious what people's thoughts are on that, and whether it's seen as a different kind of thing from ketchup.
Yeah. So I think that is still seen as being a very elutic way of conceptualizing things, and like, I think that's really what the focus of the new words castle is, more than like making sure that the stems are clear of any foreign material. Yeah, I've heard one of the elders specifically often talk about like her elutic brain. So she'll be like, that doesn't make sense to my elutic brain. So I think that's more what it's about, like using these conceptualizations that are very elutic rather than like sort of a purist ideology. Yeah.
When there are English words or Russian words that are used in a code-switching manner, is there a particular suffix? Are they included? Like, are they inflected for like dual or plural in the way that they're partially incorporated, or are they just used bare as in the English form?
The stems?
Yeah.
So you don't get stems being inflected for number before any of these paste. Post spaces, so it's kind of like a moot point.
Oh, you can't.
If you want to. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The exception to that, I guess, is possession relations. So like the words buttons for keyboard,
that
is plural. Yeah.
Okay. But when you're code switching, it doesn't. It's kind of a moot point.
Code switching is weird. I'm still looking at that, but I found weird like mismatches. So sometimes the elutic verb will be inflected as if the object is singular, but then it will be like a plural loan word with a plural elutic demonstrative attached to it. So I don't really know what's going on with that yet. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have time for one or two more questions.
Does the New Words Council have sort of rules for if you want to make a new word, follow these steps, or is it more sort of spontaneous?
I think it's pretty organic. Unfortunately, I haven't actually attended a meeting of it, but based off of what April Counselor talks about when she describes it, it sounds like it's pretty organic and pretty elder-led. Yeah, so it's not like a very formulaic process. It's more like people toss around ideas for a while, something sort of picks up traction, and then everyone decides to go with one thing.
Sorry, I came in a little late, and this may not be important to your research, but I know just a little bit about from the writing of Father Michael Alaska and Richard Dauenhauer, that in the first phase, or in the major phase of Russian influence before the American purchase, there was like a flourishing of alley popular literacy in a Cyrillic-based orthography, and so I don't know if you could even work with any of those materials, or if you have.
Yeah, so I personally haven't, but actually the elders are very interested in using Cyrillic to represent Russia, and many of them feel that it works better and more easily than English orthography. The learners are less enthusiastic about that because they don't know Cyrillic, but the elders have organized like this little reading group to try and do that.
And I think we have time for one last question, if there are. Okay, let's thank our presenter.